Ja, 2017 war ich mit meiner Familie in Dänemark im Urlaub. Ich habe das, glaube ich, auch im Podcast schon mal erzählt. Habe dort, oder es ist dann so, dass meine Frau immer, wenn wir im Urlaub sind, irgendein Touristenbüro oder ähnliches aufsucht und dann so Heftchen mitbringt, wo drin steht, was man in der Gegend so machen kann. Und beim Durchblättern
Ja.
dieses Touristeninformationsblatts, war dann eine kleine Anzeige von Tüviski und dass man da an Tastings teilnehmen kann. Und dann habe ich ganz spontan auf der Homepage ein Tasting gebucht und bin dann dahin gefahren im Urlaub in Dänemark. Das ist so, Thy ist ein Nationalpark eigentlich und das ist so ja, südlich vom Skagerrak, aber ist so Nordwest Dänemark. Also von hier, ich weiß nicht, von Leipzig aus fährst du da 10 Stunden oder so. Fährst du nochmal 4 Stunden allein durch Dänemark oder 3 oder so, ne? Also na, 4 fast. Also ist schon
Ist ja wirklich
wirklich
ganz oben am Zipfel, ja.
wirklich am Arsch der Heide. Und ja, bei diesem Tasting, es war wunderschön, hat extrem viel Spaß gemacht und ich bin dann am Ende mit einem 10% Fassanteil eines 5 Liter PX-Fasses rausgegangen, was im kurz nach meiner Abreise befüllt werden sollte. 50 Liter Fass sollte es sein, es waren 47 Liter Fass und 4,7 war dann mein 10% Share.
Ja.
Und ich hatte dann das PX-Fass, es gab noch eine Auswahl Oloroso oder PX, zu der Zeit fand ich irgendwie PX nicer und habe deswegen die PX-Auswahl getroffen. Und jetzt, kurz vor Weihnachten, ist dann mein Fassanteil angekommen. Das
Klingt mit
heißt,
großer Freude
genau, das
erwartet.
heißt, acht halbe Liter Flaschen, von denen 2 für mich sind und 6 für Freunde und Verwandte, die sozusagen sich in diese 10% mit eingekauft haben. Und zusätzlich habe ich noch 3 Proben mitgesendet bekommen von Thy Whisky. Und da habe ich mich schon gefragt, wofür die sind, habe da aber gar nicht so irgendwie, habe das auch vergessen wieder, dass ich diese Proben hatte, wie
Ja.
das halt so ist mit Samples, die man irgendwo rumstehen hat. Und dann gab es eine Mail auf Dänisch und ich erkenne das immer daran, dass der Betreff immer der gleiche ist. Da steht dann für die Cask-Owner sowieso und dann stehen da die Cask-Nummern. Und deswegen weiß ich, das war auch
Ja.
für mich gedacht und ich antworte dann immer dem Jakob von Thy Whisky, antworte immer, hey, kannst du das mal kurz für mich auf Englisch zusammenfassen? So, und dann sagt er, klar, kein Problem. Und es ist so, eigentlich hätte es ein Apfelfest geben sollen, wo alle Cask-Owner eingeladen worden wären, dass man seinen Anteil dann gleich mitnimmt, was, wie gesagt, für mich aus Deutschland sowieso nichts gewesen wäre. Aber das ist halt wegen Corona ausgefallen. Die sind
Endlich.
auch in einer ganz speziellen Lockdown noch, weil die irgendwie Nerzfarmen auch in der Nähe haben. Deswegen gelten da nochmal härtere Regeln als anderswo in diesem Nationalpark. Und deswegen haben die gesagt, wir machen das so, wir machen ein virtuelles Tasting mit diesen Proben und dem Fass, was dann nachher geworden ist für jeden. Und er sagt, ja, der Call ist auf Dänisch, aber du kannst natürlich gern teilnehmen. Oder noch besser hat er mir dann angeboten, wir können ja telefonieren, wir beide, und dann machen wir das im Anschluss daran. Und da habe ich natürlich dem Jakob geantwortet, nachdem ich mich kurz mit dir abgestimmt habe, ob es nicht eine viel bessere Idee wäre, statt einem One-to-One-Telefonat einfach einen Podcast zu machen.
Schlauer Olli.
Und da sind wir.
Nein, ich bin auf jeden Fall gespannt, was das wird. Und für euch, die ihr zuhört, das Ganze wird nicht auf Deutsch stattfinden, wie ihr gerade schon mitbekommen habt.
Ja,
Finde ich schwierig, denn wir sprechen kein Dänisch.
genau. Aber der Jakob spricht Englisch und der Tim spricht super Englisch. Der ist nämlich Englischlehrer. Wird schon
Ich
schief gehen.
versuch's zumindest. Ja. Von daher wird es ganz entspannt. Also, viel Spaß bei der Session gleich. Wir freuen uns wie Bolle.
Herzlich willkommen zu Dram Good, dem Whisky-Podcast. Mein Name ist Oliver.
Ich bin Tim.
Und wir wollen heute mit euch bummelig eine Stunde über das Thema Whisky sprechen. Aber heute nicht in Deutsch wie sonst, sondern heute in Englisch. So, let's switch to English. Hello, Andreas. Hello, Jakob.
Hello, Oliver. Hi.
Nice to have you on the show.
Hey, you too. Also,
I made a small introduction. I explained that I was in vacation in Tue and by the part of your cask. Mm-hmm. So our audience knows the circumstances why we are now sitting in a virtual meeting and in a virtual podcast. But what I did not have done is to introduce you as persons. Perhaps you can introduce yourself. Is it okay for you?
Definitely. Let's do that. Yeah, and thanks a lot, Oliver, for joining our shared cask program as the first German, actually, and the first foreigner to join the program. We didn't quite target this for others than Danes from the beginning. So it was a nice thing you came by, and we had some nice conversations underway. So I very much appreciate that. But for the introduction, my name is Jakob Stjernholm, and I'm the co-owner of Tue Whisky, along with Andreas. And Tue Whisky is both like a distillery, but we also have a farm and a malt house at our family farm, which is the location of everything. So this is the place we try and do everything from soil to bottle, actually.
Yeah. So we're actually brother-in-laws. Mm. We are married in to this family farm. We joined the farm 4 years ago. We are part of eighth generation here at the farm. So the farm itself dates back to until 13th century, but our family has been here for 300 years. Yeah. During farming, and the story of making whiskey here is now 10 years old.
Very nice. 300 years, a stable family business, I think.
We're getting there.
Yeah, we're getting there. Slowly getting there. Yeah.
No, very cool. So in 2017, when I was on vacation, you was in a from my view, not a real distillery. If someone asked me what Tue Whisky is, I said to the people, it's a whiskey maker.
Yeah.
So, what happened? What changed?
Well, a lot has happened since then, and this is just going to be the short version of the history that we are part of. So basically, we started making whiskey, as you said, 10 years ago. And making whiskey at that point meant that we had this idea to make Danish whiskey, or even like whiskey from Tue, meaning that we wanted to explore what the terroir and the local resources we have here at the farm, the grains we grow in our fields, whatever we could find to like smoke grains with to make smoke whiskey and so on. Where could we take that? Would that be an interesting approach to whiskey? And in the beginning, it wasn't building a distillery from day one. So we started out finding a place to actually malt the grains. It started with a very, very small place in Denmark and moved on to a German malt house before we could open our own malt house in 2018. So that was actually 8 years in the project that we finally managed to put up our own drum malting system that we designed, because nobody actually builds these small scale systems anywhere in the world, at least not ones that have been tried out anywhere. So it started out as a production where we connected with like local people and local resources. There was a guy building a nearby distillery, so we distilled at his site in the beginning. At some point, we put up a still at his location together with him. So when you visited us in 2017, we actually just put up, or a year before that, we put up a larger still at his place to be able to make more whiskey for us, and he was doing other things. But it wasn't until 2019 in summer that we actually put up our own distillery at at our farm. And since then, we've been making much more whiskey, obviously. It was supposed to be the next step for our production. And before that, in 2016, we actually started brewing all the wort for our production here. And even before that, we had the barrels lying here. We did the cask aging and the blending and the bottling here. So it's been a story for us of starting out with experiments from our own grains and from casks that we wanted to try out and see where that would take us before we actually started out a full distillery operation at our site. And just to, well, in the beginning, we didn't, Andreas and I, we didn't live here at the farm at that point. We had a very different background. I was working in administration in Copenhagen, in the Ministry for Transport. So that's a very different career. And Andreas is an engineer, also working in government and larger companies in Copenhagen. So our background is very different, and very different from going back to not only making whiskey, but also running a farm. We have 200 cows and running a dairy farm. We're running a malt house now and a distillery as well. So it's been a long process of going from experiments with the idea of making whiskey from our grains and our soil, and going all the way to actually establishing our company as a full distillery, which we are now. We're doing everything single estate at our premises today, where everything is made here and doesn't leave the place until it's a bottle of finished whiskey.
But it's a different approach to whiskey making. We're farmers. We came from the grain. We started off with the grain. We ended up with the still. It's like the whiskey process, but that's been our way into it, actually. And it's been the core of whatever we've done from the beginning and still is. It's the grain that we grow on our soils.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that I think many people dreaming of making whiskey would probably start with setting up the still, right? And they would start, you know, distilling whiskey from that. And then they would maybe move backwards and say, well, let's try and, you know, work with the grains or whatever, if they ever wanted to do that. But we found out that it made sense for us being farmers that we, you know, took it from bottom up and ended with the distilling, because it was such a big task actually breaking, you know, getting the right system in place for actually malting in small scale and doing this in a viable way. The way we do it now, we don't use all the grains ourselves from a malt house. We maybe use 20 or 25%. The rest is actually going out to other distilleries, mostly in Denmark, or other breweries in Denmark. So our ambition is, sometimes we tell ourselves that we hope that we could be able to, you know, give that tiny spark to something here in Denmark so we can get something that's out of the ordinary in raw materials for whiskey production. So we don't just use industrially produced malts, but we can smoke it in a different way, or we can malt it in a different way to create flavor and taste that's locally bound. For us, it's here in Thy, it's our fields. For another distillery, it could be the local farmer next to him. And we do that for other distilleries as well. So it's been a very interesting journey actually to create that, because in Denmark we have three large malt factories producing tons of malt, like 100,000 tons every year. And it's cheap and you get alcohol out of it and it's probably really good. They export to Scotland, so you make Scottish whiskey out of it as well. But it's very different from what we do, and we get so much flavor from the grains that we hope that could be a way into creating like a flavor profile for Danish whiskey, because who in the world knows what Danish whiskey is right now? But hopefully in a few years that people will know. And we're not the only ones making whiskey here. There's actually a few others, thinking about how small the country is. Some are new and some are even older than our production and larger scale. So it's an interesting time in Denmark for whiskey, I think. And hopefully, this is one conversation, but hopefully there will be many others around the countries around us trying to figure out what Danish whiskey can be.
That sounds very, very interesting. Also, the approach of focusing on the grains or barley and the different varieties. I think that's also a very, very good idea at the right time. If I look over the North Sea towards Scotland, for example, Daftmill or Kilcoman, they also have approaches like this, that mm-hmm. you have the terroir influencing the flavor profiles of those distilleries. And why not also Denmark? I find it very, very interesting. So I lift my hat for that.
Well, thanks a lot. And it's funny because we had we sent, like, we're exporting a few bottles of our whiskey for Germany, but also for England. Mm-hmm. It's not a lot right now. It's just a little bit. And honestly, we don't have a lot of bottles to spare right now because there's a huge demand for our whiskey here in Denmark. But we know that there's going to be a future where we can supply more. So obviously we want to be open to other markets as well. So also again, thank you for taking this conversation with us in that sense. But we were invited for, the Whiskey Show, which is a whiskey exchange. It's a large retailer in London, and they make a whiskey show every year. This year, obviously, it was a virtual show instead of a physical show, which is always a shame, but that's the way it is. So we actually, I attended a debate with the Waterford Distillery as well, and Kilhoman. Mm-hmm. And Waterford is an Irish distillery, if you don't know, and they work with distilling like single farm. So they get grains from other farms and they distill that and see if that makes a difference. And Kilhoman grow a lot of the grains themselves and malt themselves. And we had this discussion about what barley actually does for the whiskey. Like what does differences in barley and differences in malting actually do for the whiskey? And it was quite nerdish. It was, I think, because it's not, it should be very basic for whiskey production, because it seems that, you know, the ordinary way of doing it is actually getting that distillery and then you buy in distilling malts and just make whiskey. But basically the way whiskey started out was probably, you know, local farms, having a small still and it got bigger. And of course somebody took it even bigger at some point. But everything started out quite local. I'm pretty sure that you got the local grains, you molded it themselves and so on. So the way we're doing it now, where everything is single estate, was basically probably just the way you did it. If you went back 150 years, everything just moved away. So it was perceived as a quite nerdish session, but basically I think it was about something very, very basic to whiskey production. And the point we all had, the three of us working with grains in that way, is that you create so much difference in flavor and profile from the grains. And in two ways, old heritage varieties of barley that we are working with create a much different flavor than modern varieties. And if we mold it differently, as well, modern or old varieties, we can create so much difference in flavor in the malting process. If we do a caramelized malt, it's a way of malting where you use, you know, different moisture and different temperature in the malting process. You create the caramel flavors in the malts. If we use that in our distilling, you get this, you know, intense caramel flavor. It's not even just a hint of caramel. It's almost too much. If you add too much of it, it's so intense, and it's still malt. It's still single malt. It's just malt and water, and there's nothing added. And it's just, you know, differences in the process of malting, of creating the raw materials, that just creates a totally different whiskey. And maybe we should, I know we talk just a bit about the other processes, because, you know, it's a very long process of making whiskey. And we start by growing the grains, you malt the malts, you brew a beer, basically, you distill it, then you wait for I don't know how long on casks before you actually get a bottle of whiskey out of it. But the whole idea here is that there's so much difference in every single step. And the way we distill is quite different as well. So our distilling process has always been made that way, that it's a traditional pot still. There's no column on our still or anything else like that. But we have this purifier system. In German, you call this Deflegmator or Deflegmator. And it's a system where you have it's almost like a second condenser holding back some of the water and some of the heavier oils in the distillation process. So you get a clearer spirit through, but you never stop the vapors. So it means that every single drop of distillate coming out, which is a condensed vapor from the distillation process, is created in the pot. So it's actually from the beer directly. So you get very much flavor through, and we just make one distillation and we get the final distillate out of it. So it's a different way of approaching distillation from the traditional Scottish, like two distillations or Irish three distillations or whatever you want to, you like all the traditions that you find around. So it's a very different way that we do it. That's not a single way that we do it in Denmark, but this is the way we approach it. And this has been, honestly, we didn't know too much about this before we started, but it turned out it really helps us with our project of making, you know, the malts, the grains, really give the flavor and taste to the whiskey. That this is a very direct way of putting flavor into your distillate. You get the vapors directly from the pot, and you don't distill that again. Every time you capture the vapors, make them into distillate, and then vaporize it again by boiling it again, you lose some of the flavors, and you get some others. So it's not a good thing, bad thing, but it's just another way of doing it that really helps us in what we want to achieve.
I think before we start into details, to stick into details, we should taste one of the nice whiskeys you sent.
Definitely. Yeah. A short introduction. So what we're tasting today, just to connect this with what Oliver said in the beginning, Oliver bought into one of our shared casks. And the principle in this is that you just buy 5 liters in one cask, and then you wait for 3 years or 5 years or how long we say it's going to take. And then we bottle the whiskey when we think it's done, approximately at that date. So Oliver bought in to 5 liters of one cask, which was a 50-liter PX sherry cask. And actually, underway, this cask has been moved from a seasoned PX cask, as we call it. Let's get to that. And then into another cask. So it's actually been on 2 casks. So he bought into this program. So the samples we sent you it represents some of the last bottles that we made, some of the last whiskeys we made, but also represents some things that puts your shared cask bottles into perspective of what we're doing. So different types of casks, different types of distillates. Should we, let's start with the beginning. So we send out this small, like for all the cask owners, you probably can't see this on, I don't know, can you see this on screen? Maybe you can post it somewhere. You probably can't see it, but there's 4 small samples. So the first one, if you go for that, it's a grain whiskey. The second one is a single malt whiskey. And then we have 2 cask samples of single malt. So the one is a cask still lying in our warehouse. And the last one is your whiskey. So it's basically these 4 things. But let's start out with the spelled rye.
Yeah. Are you up for the spelled rye to start up with?
Yeah, fine.
Yeah. We already poured our samples a couple of minutes ago.
Good.
Yep. I have an hour.
So the first one, it's actually a release we did this September. So it's one of our newest releases. It's not a single malt whiskey. It's done from inspiration from one of Jacob and I's first study trips. We did a study trip to the US to study small malting systems. And on the way, we had a fair share of rye whiskeys. And we ended up concluding that we need to do a rye. Both because it's an interesting genre of whiskey, but also because we grow a lot of rye on our fields. So in this particular case, this is spelt rye. So it's a mixture of spelt rye and barley. matured on virgin oak, new oak. And it's a mix of 2, 3, and 4 year old, no, 2 and 3 year old casks. So it's technically in European or Scottish context, not a whiskey yet. So we called it a grain spirit instead.
So what you will experience here is that from the new oak casks, you get a lot of vanilla flavor. You get a lot of some oakiness. In the taste, it's tannins, so it's bitterness. It's also quite sweet when you smell it. And spicy, slightly spicy as well. Now there's a hint of something that, you know, here in Thy, we're located next to the North Sea. So we have these large heaths. And there's a bit of scent from like this flowering of the heaths in like September or August, depending on the year, that's in here. It's a bit like flowers, a bit like raspberry, something like that. It actually comes from some of the oddest brews and distillates we did, some of the very first spilled rye distillates we did in the beginning. I don't think we'll ever admit that it was like there was anything wrong with those productions, but it at least turned out very interesting. Sometimes when you do small batch distillation, you get like large differences in the product coming out, and especially when you're trying to figure out the product. So some of these notes are actually from some of the very some of the most unique casks that we have lying around. Just small parts of it.
The first thought of Tim was that is. It smells a little bit like gin in the first nose. Like a gin nose. And it reminds me only from the nose, or from an early nose, half an hour ago, to a young Irish whiskey, West Cork or stuff like that. So the first nose. Now it's changing. It's more vanilla, more oakiness, et cetera.
And I think, especially when you warm it up a bit, I think you get more of the character and sweetness and oakiness there. It fills out more of the nose as well. I think the floral parts of this whiskey is quite intense. And I get the point that you said, like it's gin-like. It's not gin, but it's not the juniper. But it has some spiciness and floral notes in there that's not that you wouldn't normally associate a lot with Scottish whiskey. And this is not Scottish whiskey. As Andrea said, this is inspired from American whiskey. It's inspired from American whiskey tradition, which is very spicy, very sweet, very intense in aromas.
But it's not too hot.
No,
after tasting, it's not hot for 2 years.
So in the nose, I get the vanilla. I love the freshness. It's very, welcoming. And, it certainly has some herbal notes as well.
Yeah.
It's warming inside.
Very much so yes.
You're sitting in a warehouse. So I think at your place, it's a little bit colder than in my kitchen. So I don't need to warm it up, but it's warming from inside.
Yes, it is. And it's when you use rye for making a distillate, it gets very spicy, almost like pepper. I say like maybe not black pepper so much, you know, the very like the sharp spicy pepper, maybe like rose pepper, you know, the red pepper you can get use as well. So it has this slight sweetness, but it's very spicy. Yep. And it hangs on. You can still like taste it a long time after you had this whiskey. It's still very spicy. And this is like the signature of rye. When you get this peppery, spicy flavor through, that's the whole point of rye. And in Denmark here, I think, I don't know if you visited Denmark many times, but we always eat rye bread. Like some of the only people in the world actually eating rye in those amounts. So this is very familiar for a Dane, but I'm not sure it is for everyone in the world.
Germany too. Germany too. A rye bread nation.
Yeah. It is different though. Danish rye bread is something else.
Okay. What is it?
Jakob, you have to be proud of of what's local. Yeah.
Yeah. Fine. Jakob, can you say something about the mash bill? The percentages of spelled and rye? Is it more rye driven or more spelled driven? What is it?
Yeah. So the mash bill of this is, it's on the bottle. I don't know if you can, maybe you can see this.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Now
yeah,
you can
now
see
it's okay. Getting there. Mm-hmm. So we actually wrote this on the table. And, this is actually just slightly less than 50% rye. So normally we make it above 50% in the newest versions. But this has been a mix of all our experiments. So it ended up a very odd number of percentages here. But basically we aim for, at least 50%, maybe even 60 or 70% rye. And then, 15 to 20% barley and spelt. So it's like 50-50 of those. The barley is basically just to get the enzyme process going in the brewing process. And the spelt is both a way to ease the brewing process, but it's actually a very spicy type of wheat. So it gives the whiskey like a lighter touch. It's not as hot and spicy as you would find some rye whiskies, but it still warms and it still has that spice going there, but a little less pepper than you could find. So it's a mix of at least 70% of rye and spelt, or 80%, and then the rest is barley.
But I just had a sip, and what came to my mind, the mouth feel is incredible. It's so I don't know. It's so creamy and so full. I didn't expect that from the nose.
No.
Right now, I'm kind of overwhelmed. It's very good. And also, if you had a first sip and put your nose in afterwards again, it's a whole nother picture. And very, very nice. So
now this is our. This is a grain whiskey, and it's a rye whiskey, and it's virgin oak casks or new oak casks. And I feel that when you have this kind of whiskey, not only the one we do, but every single bourbon or rye that you get, you kind of get like all the flavors at once. So you get all the spiciness and sweetness and oakiness, and everything is just in there. And sometimes when you get a single malt whiskey, we'll move on to that later, you maybe get a more like balanced feel of tasting it. So maybe you get like, first it's strong, you get the alcohol, and then there's sweetness, and then there's smoke, and then there's something else. So you get like waves of flavor coming in there. And this is quite different, and it's meant to be that. So it's meant to be everything at once, like a explosion of like smooth, spicy, sweet whiskey. You know, it sounds very American when you say it like that as well, but it's meant to be that. You sit there in the bar with a beer and the whiskey and you want to taste it immediately, right? So you're up for the next sip of the beer and then the whiskey. So you can use it like that. But actually, if you, like you say, if you just sit there with it and you take a sip and you nose it and sip it, it's actually quite complex. There's a few very interesting notes in there as well. And I get this very oily, you know, it covers the back of your throat, and it's very oily distillate. I think you'll find that from almost all the samples that we sent you, that we get this, tend to get this intensity out of the distillates that we do in the process that we have.
And it stays forever.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, Tim.
No, Oli, go on. Sorry.
I only wanted to say that I find it very interesting that this spelt rye is only 2 to 3 years old.
Yeah.
And it's so creamy and so it's peppery, but it's rounded too. So if you had asked me how old is this, I would say don't know, 8 to 10 years or whatever.
Yeah.
So from the first thinking about it, not a 2 year spirit.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
And I think it's for this type of whiskey, it's actually a really bad thing if you need 8 or 10 years. And that's because, like if you look at American whiskeys as well, there's some rules for making that whiskey that you can distill it very high. You need to make a very flavorful distillate to call it a bourbon as well. So you have to get quite low alcohol volume in the distillate, and you need to get it very balanced, because when you age it on new oak casks, after 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, you'll have so much cask intensity on the whiskey that it'll almost take over the whiskey if you let it stay. It can be so full of tannin and oakiness that it's almost too much. So you need to make a distillate here that's just extremely tasty. It's probably one of our most tasty distillates as they are. It's so peppery and full and round. Actually, we should just drink it like it is and not put it on the cask. No, but it's the way you need to make this whiskey. It has to be so flavorful, and it needs to be round after 2 or 3 or 4 years. And the reason we didn't wait until 3 years isn't only impatience. That could be one explanation. But actually, the whiskey was just ready for bottling. And of course, it depends on the size of the casks and the way the distillate is. But this mix of barrels was the one that we favored, and it made the best whiskey for us. So that's why we bottled it. And we didn't care too much about not being able to call it a whiskey. Maybe the next bottling we'll do, it'll be like 3-year-old casks. It could be. But it's not all important for us for this bottle, because it's so American inspired, and in the US, the rules are very different for whiskey. So this would be a straight rye whiskey if it was made in the US. So it's about flavor for us and finding the balance. We don't want the cask to take over. And this is, our second bottling of spilt rye, and definitely the one where the rye and the cask are really, you know, getting there. But for us, even 10 years in making whiskey, we're not done yet. We're just starting out. So it's going to evolve in the next years as well. But we're quite satisfied with this one. It really has a very nice, welcoming, sweet and round and spiciness, you know, spicy flavor to it. That's just a really, really nice. Everyone likes this whiskey when we sit down at the table, see in the distillery and taste it like nobody. Maybe it's not the favorite whiskey. Maybe not for that many people, but it's still like a whiskey that's just so easy to drink. And it's just very nice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was looking at my sample. It has 50% ABV. That's quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't feel like it.
No.
So I like it.
No.
Spilt rye.
But you know, there's a difference in like ethanol would always taste strong in your mouth. So if you have a high ABV, you'll get like it's a warm and maybe very strong flavor, but it shouldn't be. In Danish, you say spritel. I don't know if it's like spritzig or something in German, but it, you know, if it tastes chemical
spritzig.
Something like that. It's a bad thing, right? And you should never bottle anything that has that, you know, that sharp flavor. Sharpness isn't a very good thing, but you can have a strong alcohol flavor, and that's good. If you have sweetness with strong, it's like making Thai food. You want sweet and strong, and it's a good thing. So it's kind of the same thing here. That when you have the balance, it doesn't matter if it's 50%. It could be even more and still be smooth and balanced.
I think also the presence of oils in the distillate really, really helps, cover up, but helps that the alcohol levels can be higher, because the distillate is so oily as it is.
Yeah. So it's kind of mellowing it down.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yes.
For sure.
Yeah. Nice. Perfect.
You explained that this is batch 2 of your spelled rye whiskey. Is it a philosophy of Two Whiskey to do everything in batches? or are you working on this?
We do bottlings.
Are you working on the standard whiskey?
We tend to look at batches on a yearly basis. So we have an annual circle. So, and we tend often to do our rye distillates just immediately after harvest. That's the technical grain thing on dormancy of barley and so on. So we tend to do our rye distillates in a period of a few months, and we consider that a batch. On the bottle, that's a bottling, and this is our second bottling of spilled rye, and we will for sure be doing another and multiple bottlings of spilled rye. But we do limited bottlings. We don't do a spilled rye, and that's then our spilled rye for the remainder of the period. We're young in the whiskey business. We've only been making whiskey for 10 years, and our products are evolving. So we only do limited bottlings. This particular bottle here was just above 1,000 bottles. For this mm-hmm. long one that we are tasting right now, and we don't know when our next spilled rye bottling will be ready. But it will be another limited release at another point. So yeah. we look at each bottle as a unique batch or unique bottling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you're not. I understand you're not. Cask driven or something else. You are farm driven from the grain. So in the batch thinking.
Well, in some sense, because that's the way we produce the distillate.
Yeah.
But obviously, this being a mix of 2, 3, 4 year old mm-hmm. Spilled rye casks, when we make a bottling, it's not fixed with the batch. So it's not like we make a batch 1 year and well, 3 years later, we'll bottle that. We look at every cask and see, is that cask ready? Is this interesting? Would it improve the whiskey if we add this cask to the 5 others or 2 others or how many cask it is? And if it doesn't add to the quality, we wouldn't add it for the whiskey. So, when we bottled 1,000 bottles, that was the maximum number of bottles that we thought we could get out of the spilled rye cask that we had that would make a good bottling. So it turned out to be 1,000. The last bottling, the next one that we'll taste, had about 1,800 bottles. And that was about the maximum that we thought we could make from that. So it's sometimes it's single, not single cask, but it could be 3 or 4 or 5 or 7 or 6 casks that are put together as they are. Sometimes it's very different casks that are put together for one bottling. But still, having this very small, like slow startup in production, the volumes that we have to work with right now for bottling are very, very small. So even making 2,000 bottles is an extremely high number of bottles for one whiskey right now. And obviously that's an insanely small amount of bottles for sending something to Germany and England and Denmark and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But but for us, it's not a way of exporting a lot of bottles and trying to push out bottles from the warehouse. It's more just slowly creating some awareness and trying to get people to taste our whiskey and see what we're doing here in Denmark and maybe be interested in seeing what's coming in the next years. But yeah, basically it's like that. We do a bottling and people have to, you know, believe us that the next bottling is going to be good as well, because it's never going to be the same.
Yep.
Of course, that could make it interesting if you're like into collecting whiskey or something like that. It could be interesting to, you know, have like all the different editions, but it's mostly for us a way of saying that we just have some limits in the amount of whiskey that we have lying around right now with age on it. So we can't do any more than this, and we won't really make, you know, want to say that this is going to be the whiskey for the next 50 or 100 years, because we're just starting out. And I think we'll feel that we're just starting out even for the next 10 or 20 years, because it takes so long to build up that age and character. So we don't want to limit ourselves with a certain product that we figure out by now, if we could do it even better. So we just want to, improve the quality every time if possible, and just present different things.
Nice.
I also think producing a constant product for the next couple of decades, one can leave that up to big players on the market. Yes. So it's always interesting to have small distilleries that have character, that improve, that evolve. That's the interesting thing, at least for me, to try to create new flavors. And so I totally understand what you mean.
New flavors. Let's move on.
Sure.
the second one, Stoffed.
So this is the next bottle. We'll try this again. I don't know if this works, but maybe you can see it here. You just got the small sample bottle. Mm-hmm. You can, this is called the number 13 Stout. And the bottle looks like this. You can see all these bottles at our website as well. So you can check out all the information.
Yeah.
This is an interesting bottle, we think. it's bottled at around 50% again. So this is 51% alcohol volume. It's a 3-year-old single malt whiskey, but it's still, again, it's a mix of something slightly older and something just above 3 years old. This has a very unique story for us. Because it's actually the first time that we were able to make like a mix of whiskeys and make that into one bottling. When you make whiskey, what you need is a large warehouse with a lot of casks in them, interesting casks that you can choose whiskeys from and make into your next bottle. And this is actually a mix of some of our bourbon casks, some of our sherry casks, some casks with smoke, some without, some are PX sherry, some are Oloroso sherry, some have been like seasoned sherry casks, as you call it, which are basically new oak casks that are seasoned with sherry for a year or two, and then you use it for whiskey. This is a rather new way of making whiskey. So this was a mix of whiskeys that was turned into like a base, and then we did a finish actually on stout beer casks. And this has an explanation because we're working with local resources, but our casks are still from the US bourbon casks or Spain if it's sherry casks and so on. So that's not very local actually. So we thought about doing a cooperation with our great local brewery who do an amazing stout. And they borrowed some of our barrels, put their stout on there, and then we used it for finishing afterwards. So this is basically a mix of bourbon barrels, of sherry casks, and that's a bit of smoke there. This is not a smoked whiskey, but you get maybe 10% of our beechwood smoked whiskey here to just create that full flavor and very deep and long. You know, the flavor goes down to your throat and really hangs in there. It gives a different, like a second layer on the taste. And the cask finish on stout beer casks really gives this like burned, roasted malt, caramelly flavor, like dark, sweet roasted tones, but also some licorice. Not too much, but just a slight hint of licorice as well. So this is it's a mixed whiskey in that sense, that you mix all the different styles we have in our warehouse to create something that's just very balanced between different cask types and different distillates. So nothing really dominates, you know, the flavor here. It's so many things just being in balance. So that's the whole point of it. And we think this is very, very, in very interesting way, both of mixing the whiskey, but definitely also making this cask finish on these stout casks. It does something very unique to the whiskey. So this is a take on our single malt that we think is very interesting. And just a slight note, maybe we can talk about this whiskey, but this beechwood smoked whiskey was, we did like two separate releases on like purely beechwood smoked whiskey, which is quite unique in the whiskey world. It's almost always peat, but I think beechwood smoke is very native here in Denmark and in Germany as well for sausages and ham and bacon and whatever. You use it for almost every kind of food. And one of the whiskeys here was actually named the best European whiskey last year from Jim Murray, who writes the Whiskey Bible, which we were quite amazed that we were able to get that recognition. But we were also quite thrilled because it's such a definitive thing for Denmark, probably for Germany as well, to use beechwood smoke as a special thing. Actually, when we did it the first time, we thought maybe it was too trivial because beechwood smoke was used for everything here in Denmark. But then later when we did it and we had it lying on cask and we tasted it again, we thought this was very interesting because when we talk with English people or Scottish people about this, they were quite puzzled about the flavors from it. And it was very unique for them. So this could be one of the things for Danish whiskey, different kinds of smoke and beechwood smoke in particular, that we use that for smoking and not only peat. So back to this whiskey, it's a mix of that and all the other stuff. What do you think of the nose?
It has an intense sweetness. And I definitely get the licorice you mentioned. It's very nice. I feel reminded. We had a pal on this podcast recently who did a finish for a whiskey himself, and he finished it in a he made a liquor out of licorice.
Okay.
And then he used that cask to finish his whiskey, and okay. In a certain amount it reminds me on that one. The nose is full. It's sweet. It has, as you mentioned, a very, very slight amount of smoke, but not on the typical Scottish side. It reminds me, more also towards the German whiskey sometimes. But again, very welcoming, very, very also intense. In terms of flavors,
you said, Jakob, you said this the whiskey is rounded, and I think it's very rounded, but you can dig into the details. You can get the PX casks, you can get the bourbon casks, you can find all these things.
Yes.
And on the sample bottle, I read stuffed, not stout. I know,
because you're German. Yeah, yeah.
and I don't understand stuffed. I don't understand it. And then I look.
What looked, is that?
It's a Danish word, stuffed. Isn't it? It's Danish.
It's stout in Danish. Actually, yeah. it's a Jutlandish word for being proud.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it rhymes stout as well. So for us, it's the obvious name.
You know, at some point in history, the Vikings kind of invaded England. So I'm pretty sure the English word stout comes from Danish, actually. Yeah. And it does mean like proud or something like you're not, you know, people can push you, but you're not moving. You're just standing there.
Mm-hmm.
And
strong and proud.
Yeah. And people are kind of like this here. So they're kind of like, we're not that native to tea. People here, especially men, are kind of like men of a few words, but very like stout attitudes towards stuff, hard to move. So it was a kind of a funny like naming for us because it was a kind of a very local tea thing, and it with the casks as well, and still almost makes sense if you're in England at least. But well, in Germany, it turns out to be stuffed. that's a bit different. So it means the same as stout. It's the same as the English word, probably coming from Denmark at some point. Yeah. Oliver, that you have this, you have all these flavors here that it's mm-hmm. rounded, but the whole point is that you can, if you move around your palate, you can catch everything in there. There's a bourbon, there's some oak, not too much. There's some PX, there's some sherry, there's some a bit of smoke. There's, you know, in the nose, I think you actually get more Oloroso sherry cask. Like the you know, the sweetness in the nose here is quite intense. In the flavor, you get even more of the, you know, the balanced flavors of everything in here. And you still get that, you know, from smoked whiskies, this very long, deep, you know, flavor just hanging in there in your throat and everything, which is very nice.
But the smoke is not standing in front of the distillate. It's in the back. Throat. It's behind, and it gives this whiskey some more complexity or some some specialty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's like that, and this is basically 10% smoke, so it's not a lot. Like 10% of this is smoke whiskey. So we never present this as a smoked whiskey because it's really not. It's all the other things combined. And we do this smoked whiskey as well. There's no sample for you this time for the smoked one, but it's very interesting in itself as well. But it has this very sweet, it's almost like campfire or furnace mixed with a bit of, maybe a bit of licorice as well. For this, like the beechwood smoke compared to the, you know, to the peat. So it's not a thing that really dominates. It just gives some extra long flavors for the whiskey. That's basically it.
Very nice. You mentioned that, you both, if you talk about people from Tü, mm-hmm. they are stuffed like the Vikings.
Stout.
Like the Vikings. You come from Copenhagen, and Andreas, you lived a longer time in Copenhagen. How is it to change your life from a big city with all the things you can have in a city, or what you're doing there and your what's normal for you, and going to Tü? I was there for vacation. I know it a little bit, 2 weeks. Okay. Not much, but I can imagine that it's for you a big thing to change to a national park and working on a farm. Can you tell us something a little bit about how
Probably the biggest life-changing decision that we have ever done, and will do, changing the career that we had set forth from the education that we had had done, and changing out the big city. Copenhagen is maybe not that of a, but the capital of Denmark and the big city and the city life. And changing that to rural area. This is a farm. We have 10 kilometers to the nearest shop. But it didn't come without thinking. Didn't come without sleepless nights. But it turns out that what we have done here is that we have changed out our life in the city to a life where we've just moved the center of our life from the city, but to the farm. But here we are combining our family, our hobby and our work, to this very, very, close circle. So it just turns out that we changed the center of the universe from being Copenhagen to Tü. So everything is still local for us here, centered for us here. But it doesn't mean that we don't miss the city, and we, at least when it's not Corona times, luckily get to go visit the city often still. But I just think that this life just brings so much more that, it easily replaces it all. Yeah. Plus the nature here is magnificent. The national park, you saw that when you were here. The North Sea, just few minutes from here. The wildlife, everything is, well, I grew up countryside. So it's not, mm-hmm. actually, it's not that foreign for me. I lived mm-hmm. 10 years in Copenhagen, but I grew up countryside.
Very, very, very nice, region in Tø and the coast and all that. It was a little bit windy the 2 weeks I was there, I think.
It's always windy here. It's actually, I think, Tø is the most windy place of the North Sea coast in Denmark, which says a lot because it's windy everywhere. So it is like that. Some of the things, ironically, some of the things that are very, like, you think about when you think Scotland and whiskey, and you see this distillery lying, you know, next to the sea, and the water is splashing, the waves are splashing on the walls and everything. You know, that kind of climate is not too far from what we have here. And whether that's a good or a bad thing, I don't know. But at least it's, you know, the climate here is very temperate. It doesn't get too hot in summer. It doesn't get too cold in winter. And everything, even the cask aging here, I think, is more, it's a slow process. And that's at least our idea, because we never made whiskey in Southern Europe or something like that. So it's basically an idea that, when we make our whiskeys, that we would like it to express, you know, the climate here as well. We actually just this year, the new thing this year will be in a new warehouse for our whiskey, because we started making so much more whiskey. We're building a new warehouse building, that's meant to hold a couple of 100,000 liters of whiskey, made in the next years. And that's going to be, you know, almost open to nature outside, as much as possible. So we just get the natural temperatures in there and the variations in there. It's kind of like a dogma for us just to try and work with what's here and not work with what's not here, if you can put it in that way. So we don't do any bourbon whiskey because we can't grow any corn, and something like that. So we really wanted to, you know, if it's a good thing or a bad thing, if more heat is better for aging or less heat is better, or we just, you know, we have what we have here. And so we work with that and see where that takes us. That's been the approach from the beginning. So I think also moving here from the big city to the countryside and what's here, it really gets us closer to, you know, to feeling the, you know, the nature and the weather and the climate and the change, you know, the changing seasons. You feel that much more out here, and you're so far away from any distraction that you kind of, you know, have more time to think about that and what it actually means for you and for what you are actually doing. So maybe it's a good thing. Maybe it's a reason for doing something like this in the middle of nowhere. This is in Danish terms, this is in the middle of nowhere. And because you actually, you know, you don't get distracted. You don't get too many impulses from anything else. You just make whiskey, and then you do it again the next day. And hopefully you get very good at it at the end. It feels a very focused way of doing this, that this is what's here. And that's it. Apart from farming and malting as well, everything is here at the farm.
I have one more question. So you just said you stand up the next day making whiskey. Do you you don't produce every day, right? Do you have certain?
We do. So
when you produce whiskey,
we only do nope. Like, we don't do anything else. We just make whiskey every single day if possible. No, we don't work in weekends.
Oh, really?
We work in evenings.
Okay.
Maybe we don't distill every single day. Like, we'd have some holidays every year, and sometimes we take the Friday off to fill the barrels or whatever we need to do. But basically, we're nine people at the farm and the distillery. So we have like four or five people working mostly at the farm, and four people working here, including us, at the distillery and the malt house. So this is what all day, every day. We're here to fill those barrels, and we're here to make that malt and create those new flavors. So that's basically it. So we're getting if moving here was like moving into a small bubble, we're just staying in there and never leaving.
Okay. So Tim, we're operating a 1,000 liters still, and we're this year we are ending off way beyond 35,000 liters of spirit. So this it's when Oliver was here, we were a very, very small production, but we are considering ourselves a whiskey distillery now, and have a full time production. Not evenings, not nights, not weekends, but every day in the daytime hours we are distilling.
Yes. It's still a very manual process that we set up. So when we distill, it's, you know, the operator of the still, the distiller, he has to, you know, nose and taste what's ever coming out of the still. So distilling in the middle of the night, I think you need a more automated process to do that, or a lot of distillers running around. and that's a very difficult thing, because every distiller has his own taste buds, and trying to figure out and, you know, keep on track it takes a lot of focus. But this is still, like, even 30,000 liters is not, you know, it's, of course, that's a lot of whiskey if you want to drink it yourself. But in, you know, in the terms of the whiskey industry, it's still a very, very small operation. Mm-hmm. And, but still it's a lot more than before. And I think when that turns into whiskey, like ready, you know, whiskey ready for bottling, there's definitely going to be more bottles for places like Germany and England as well. We're not that many Danes here. So yes, it has some potential, but, like, we're doing everything ourselves. We don't take any investments in. So we want to build this up as organically as possible.
Yeah.
Like, the only investors we had are people like you, Oliver. That's Oliver. That's you. Because you bought this. This is kind of crowdfunding for us. Because you bought this whiskey beforehand and you got it now, 3 years later. And in that time, you know, we made whiskey for that money for ourselves. So we have more to bottle, hopefully, in the coming years. And, you know, there's more and more going into this program. And we have actually in 2 weeks, we have 90 shareholders coming by here, but they're not because of Corona, but they're supposed to come by here and fill the new generation of casks, you know, shared casks. So every half year or something, we do this. And it's a great way for us to get a bit of, you know, a bit of capital in here to work, but hopefully also getting, you know, a bit cheaper whiskey, but also, very unique bottlings out there for everyone who joins the program. And of course, you're based far away from here, but like, some people come here every year to check on the casks and be part of an event that we do. And you know, if you came by in Denmark more often, you could join those events as well. but you know, it's a great way for us to actually meet some of the very enthusiastic whiskey drinking people out there to have a conversation. So it's a great thing for us. It's crowdfunding, and it's some of the best events for us, because it's more, even more nerdish, whiskey nerdish than anything else that we do.
Yeah, a year ago I asked him if we would drive together to Tü for the bottling day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Corona, you said it.
Next year.
Yeah. Next year will not work, because before this, I have to buy a new cask share.
Yeah.
Well, you can do right
then,
now.
Then we have to wait 3 years.
You can, you can just join the next round of cask shares. This summer, we'll actually, if you're coming here this summer, we'll have some new cask shares ready for you.
Perfect. Perfect.
Yeah. No, you're welcome anyways. You can come by here if you want, and we have a lot of more whiskey lying around. So it's going to be a nice afternoon anyways. Yeah.
Very nice. Thank you. Do we want to move on?
Yeah, let's do that.
We have two to go, I think.
We do. I don't know a glass there on my hand. I said.
Ooh.
So the next
Hello, Vanilla.
This is the most finished sample that we sent you, and it's not supposed to be a finished whiskey. This is meant to be a reflection of the finished shared cask bottle that you got. So this is basically something different. It has a bit of smoke again here. It's not a lot, but it's just a slight hint. But this is a whiskey that's been aged for 4 years already on a bourbon barrel. So a bourbon barrel is a 200 liter cask
mm-hmm.
that's been used. It's the first fill barrel. So it's been used once for bourbon in the US at Heaven Hill Distillery. And then it came here and we used it for filling this whiskey.
It was lying in the front, if you go into the warehouse, it was on the left side. You had one bourbon cask when I was visiting you.
You know what? It's actually one of those casks because this is a quite old cask in our history because 4 years ago we didn't have our own distillery. So, you know, it's actually one of those casks lying around there in the warehouse. Maybe if you took the right picture, you could see it on the picture. So yeah, mm-hmm. it was in here in the warehouse at that time as well.
It was three rows down though, not two rows.
But it's meant as a reflection. This is even now, it's a quite nice whiskey. It's cask strength. So it's more than 60% alcohol. We fill our cask at 63%. It's a quite pure, clean distillate with that hint of smoke. But you really still in this whiskey, because it's bourbon cask aged and everything goes a lot slower than on sherry casks, you can still feel and taste the distillate as it was, but it's much more rounded now. So you have this clear, bright, clean distillate with a slight hint of smoke, and you get this, I get this kind of like a dusty, grain, malty, like flavor hanging in there. And then, of course, you get some honey and some vanilla and some oakiness from the casks. But it's not too intense yet because these bourbon barrels, they work so much slower than the smaller casks. So you can really still feel where it's coming from. And the whiskey we're going to taste afterwards, the shared cask, is a like purely sherry cask aged whiskey. So that's a totally opposite direction. Everything is very intense from the cask. So just to actually, it's a thought experiment. What would have happened if we put your distillate on a bourbon cask instead?
Yeah, everything you said.
Nice.
It's sweet. It's vanilla. It's honey.
I didn't have the slight smoke on the nose, but if you focus on the palate, it comes through a little bit.
Yes, but it's a very very light smoke. So. Mm-hmm. We didn't choose this for the smoke. We chose this for the bourbon cask to compare it with the cask aging mostly. Because the smoke is just there to just add a tiny hint. When we made this distillate, it wasn't 100% smoke malt. It was just a small portion on this cask. And the smoke malt for this was quite, mild in the beginning. So it's not a smoke whiskey. It's a bourbon cascade whiskey, but it's a nice way for you to experience, like, what does our distillate, like our basic distillate do when you can still like feel it after 4 years on a bourbon cask, when it's not too overshadowed by all these different casks and flavors. Yeah.
In 2017, we tasted, I think the first dram was the new make in the tasting round. And, it's not like this, but it was easy to drink like this for over 60%. It's not so sharp. It's sharp a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
I think
it was 60.
The palate. It's the alcohol.
Over 60. It's over 60.
Yeah. But it reminds me to the tasting we had and the new make we tested, and I think what?
Yeah.
Don't taste like new make.
No, and it's a funny thing because when I taste this whiskey, I would get some, like, if you'd say like a Speyside whiskey, a Highland whiskey or something like that, a lot of those wouldn't have more cask flavor than this one.
they would have a bit, you know, a few more years, probably round the distillate a bit. But even then, like, this is 60%, and I actually enjoy drinking it like that. So it is a quite round and you get this fatty oil feel. Oh. Like, this, it's very smooth as well. So that helps as well to balance some of the strength of the alcohol. So you can take that, you know, that strong alcohol gives you a kick. We kind of enjoy that kick. We always bottle our whiskeys quite strong because we like it better that way. It, even though it's not smoke, you get a kick out of the strength, like the strong alcohol. But when it's balanced with that fattiness and that sweetness that's in there, it's actually a very nice, it complements, each other. So even this is not a finished whiskey. This would probably be, you know, a couple of years before we would even consider bottling this.
Yeah.
But I don't know about you, but I can actually enjoy this. Like, we get quite happy when we taste this, because we think, wow, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
This is going to be
tasting the future here.
We're tasting the future, and we're quite happy. Yeah.
Definitely. If I imagine this at the age of 12 or something, this is going to be perfect. Yeah. May I ask you about the fermentation time? How long do you ferment?
Yeah, we can do a bit more details on this. So, it's not always the same recipe. We've been a few years ago, because we had to transport the wort, the fermented wort, we had to transport that for the distillery. We would actually spend a bit more time fermenting, because it would keep on fermenting on the way. But basically what we aim to do is ferment for at least 1 week, so 7 days, which is quite long for traditional whiskey making. But it could be even more. And back when this whiskey was made, it would be maybe even 2 weeks in fermenting. Wow. Basically, like, the fermentation is quite fast. After 2 or 3 days, all the sugars in the wort that we brew would be turned into alcohol. So what happens after that is that you get esterification, and you get you get some development in the flavors in the wort after the first 3 or 4 days. And even if there's just a slight bit of sugar left, you can even get some, because we don't, when you make the whiskey, you kind of like you mash the malts. So you get the wort out of it, but we never boil the wort as when you would if you were making beer. So it's still very much alive there in the days after that. So if you keep it for a longer time, you can even get, you know, catch a slight scent of sour that could give you like citrusy flavors or like different complexity in the distillate afterwards. So you really catch some things in there by letting the fermentation go on for a bit longer. So that's our philosophy, but it's, I don't know exactly why we chose to do that. I think it just evolved from what we were doing because there was a natural process of waiting before we could actually transport the wort to the distillery. Then it just, you know, it just became the way we did it. But I think it's always like some of the most interesting distillates are when there's just, you know, that slight bit of sour or the slight bit of funkiness or something else coming in there. So it's not 100% clean. But, you know, it's always a mix, and we just enjoy if there's small differences in the distillate in the end, because then in 3 or 4 years, we'll have those small differences in flavor to work with in making the whiskey. And this, basically, the one we're tasting right now was a quite purely, you know, it's very pure. It's there's not many like hints of anything funky in this one. It's quite clean. So we just have the, you know, the malty, dusty, grainy thing and a bit of smoke, and that's it. And it's very nice and very approachable, I think.
Yeah. What I have is that you mentioned it's fatty. It's butter.
Yeah,
it's buttery, and that's also what I often get, for example, with Draftmill from Scotland. They also have long fermentation time, and that I don't know. Maybe that's a thing for long fermentation that the whiskey gets a little bit buttery. I really enjoy that. It's very good. Also for such a young age, I'm really impressed.
I don't think we don't have any research or or documentation to support, you know, what it does for the whiskey. And many of the things that we're doing are you know, we started out so small that we're still like fermenting in like plastic tanks, and it's, you know, it's very crude in some way, but it works very well in so many other ways. So our processes are very little, you know, there's very little automation, and there's room for like a lot of flavors evolving there.
I think that actually quite an important part of making whiskey is to do flaws, especially in the brewing process and the fermentation process. Control your flaws though, but do flaws, because they bring in
character
or nuances,
character,
the flavors. But do flaws, but control your flaws, but do flaws. I think that's an important lesson that we have learned, at least from making whiskey. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The very unique 7-day butterflow, for example.
Exactly.
Like you pointed out.
Maybe. <Yes.
laughs> No, I think it's very good. So it's amazing. And if I remember, people are always saying back in the days, people had longer fermentation times compared to what industry does right now. So, that's also fitting with your philosophy.
Yeah. And you know, you should even have had a sample of, like, we did a whiskey earlier this year called the Kornmul, which just means, well, doesn't matter too much, but it was like the 12th single malt we did. So it had the number 12. And this one has number 13, the one we tasted the last whiskey. So this number 12 was made from heritage barley, which were, we kind of like, you know, here in the Nordics, we have this gene bank for old barley varieties or grain varieties you don't use anymore. So you take like, I don't know, like some kilos of it and you store it in a deep freezer. And then you can get like a handful of it, and it's like, take good care of this. You know, it's precious. You're the one who has to take care of it now. And you get this and you can like sow it again. But obviously, like the first years you kind of harvest by scissors for a couple of years, and then you move into something slightly bigger. And in the end, you can take like a corner of a field and a bigger part of the field, and finally like a whole field. And then you can mold it, and then you can make whiskey out of
wow.
it. 6 or 7 or 8 years later. So we did this with 5 different varieties actually that we chose, and we're making whiskey out of this still. And we have these, like, some of, we didn't keep all 5, but maybe 3 of them that we grow, not for all our fields, but some of them. And it gives a totally different flavor as well. So I think, like, the way I just, the reason why I'm talking about this is, you said, you know, back in the days that you fermented for a longer time, so whiskey was better or whatever the point is. But another point is that, you know, back in the days, all barley wasn't that modern. Modern in the sense that every year you get a new variety of barley that would grow better, so you get more yield in the field. But you also get, you know, when you malt it, you get, you know, almost all the starch turns into sugar, and you get a lot of starch in there and less of other things. And probably it's not as flavorful as it was. Like, if when we use these old varieties, it's so flavorful. You know, it's horrible growing those varieties, and it's horrible harvesting them. They give a very low yield, and everything is bad. We should not do it, but it gives difference in flavor. And if I think, like, think back in the days, I would think that you would get the, you know, the local varieties lying around there. But nowadays, if you're a farmer, you just,
you're told this is the variety for Denmark and Northern Germany and Sweden and Holland and, you know, England and everything, you know, this is the variety this year. This is what everyone wants. So everyone grows the same thing. And every 3 years, it's a new one. So it's, you know, it's, I think the varieties of barley has changed so much and you don't see it because, you know, every 3 years, it's a new one. So, but after 50 years or 80 years, it's, you know, everything changed and nothing is, the local variation is gone. So I think that this has a big part to play as well for how whiskey evolved, even though, you know, it might be the same still, maybe, but you just change, you kind of like optimize the fermentation times, you optimize the barley, you optimized every part of the production into making something maybe less flavorful, but probably cheaper to make, probably cheaper to make. And it's not bad whiskey anyway, so why not drink it? So I think that working with, you know, the qualities and searching for flavor makes so much sense. And I couldn't make a lecture on fermentation, but probably you could make a lecture on fermentation in whiskey, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. And there's so much there to explore.
Perfect.
Definitely, fermentation is a whole another topic. And there's, I think, a lot to learn and a lot to discover. Same thing with barley varieties. But I'm right now, I'm just amazed with this spirit right here. It's, I didn't expect that. Oliver gave me a sample of, a cask sample of his cask, a year ago, I think. And we tasted it in our podcast together, and I was already kind of hyped about what comes next. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting also to see the spirit evolving over time. And it's just cool. I was just sitting here like the last 90 minutes smiling.
And normally he's not smiling all the time. You should know. Okay, let's move on
now to the last the one. And we have the sample.
Yeah, mine is much smaller than yours.
Yeah,
much smaller. No, actually, like it's almost like letting your child go or something like that when you because we don't keep
okay
almost we don't keep anything from these shared casks because it's not our whiskey, it's yours. Mm-hmm. But this time, because we had to do this online for the other cask owners as well, I actually kept this small 5 centiliter sample. So I'm quite happy. This is the first time that I had like a shared cask sample for like we had that for ourselves. And it's a very nice whiskey. So yeah. we'll keep this here. But let's put it in the glass.
Let it go.
So Oliver, this is a 50 liter PX cask, so your shared cask here. So this is a 50 liter PX cask made on a quite simple recipe on the distillate side. It's a non-smoked pale malt that we did the distillate on using a variety of barley called Odyssey. So the cask story here is that we started off on a seasoned PX cask. So basically a new oak cask that had contained PX for just a few years, just to infuse the PX into the cask. This was the beginning of this whiskey, but after 1 year, we did a tasting together with you, cask owners, and we decided that we should do a recasking of this whiskey. So after 1 year, we moved the whiskey to an old PX cask instead of a seasoned PX cask. The result of this is actually quite interesting because the result is both a very PX intense whiskey. We have the grain, the malt of our distillate, and the intense sweetness of the Pedro Jimenez cask, but there's also some oakiness that you wouldn't find in a normal PX sherry matured whiskey. And that originates from that seasoned cask from the first year. These tannins, this oakiness that is there that really, I think, contributes actually quite nicely to the balance and the complexity of this whiskey.
I think it almost turns this, like the PX adds this very, even in the nose, it's very like brown sugar, like Muscovado sugar, like deep, dark, sugary notes. It has those raisins as well, like almost like prunes and stuff. But when you, especially when you taste it, but also in the nose, actually, that slight hint of oak almost turns some of that sugar into like spicy, like Christmassy, spicy notes as well. Not like heavy cinnamon or anything like that, but it has like this warm, spicy feeling to it. And this oakiness from the first like seasoned PX cask actually adds to giving, you know, that sugar more complexity. So it turns into something very, I think, unique and interesting. And it tastes even older than it is. Like this is a 3-year-old whiskey, but it has some very like complex old whiskey notes in it still. And some freshness on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think it has both. It's fresh and it's old. So it's both parts are in there. I think, yeah, it's very spicy on the palate. Very nice, sweet, spicy. I had the first time I tasted it, I had some cough syrup. So a little bit behind of it.
Yeah.
But I think it's a development from the spice. This is now over an hour in the glass and then this is gone. And it's more woody spicy than syrup spicy. So yeah. Very nice.
Yeah.
What I love very much for this bottle is the transparency you give the cask owners on the label. You find the grain, the Odyssey barley sort. You find the malting. You find the cask number, age, distilling dates, bottle number. I love it. I think it's very, very nice that you give this transparency about what you're doing here. To us and it started with the cask share paper, all the information, malted at Steinbach in Germany, whatever, a lot of stuff was laying down, and I loved it from the first moment I got the paperwork. Very nice.
Well, traceability traceability basically is the cornerstone of whatever we do, whether it's our milk of the dairy farm, our grain, our malt, our whiskey. I mean, transparency and traceability is the cornerstone of whatever we do. So I'm happy that you enjoyed that, Oliver.
I love it. Can you tell me something about organic? What is organic in Denmark? Is it European Union law, or is it only about the barley, or is it about the further processes?
It's the entire process that's certified organic. Well, the barley, obviously, we are an organic farm. We've been so for 24 years this year. But the entire process is certified organically. Yeah.
There are not many organic whiskies out there, I think, globally.
Yeah.
I think Diensten has an organic one, and one organic bottling.
I think there's a few Scottish who does organic bottlings. I think there is even a few Scottish distilleries that are 100% organic, but probably only a few. Honestly, it's not something that we think that much about.
Okay.
It's just for us, it's the only natural thing to do. As we actually, we don't even split it out loud on the bottle.
But the thing is, for the people,
obvious thing to do. Of course, it's organic.
The people buying your milk or buying your whiskey, they are looking at these facts, I think.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure some are, but I always think that, you know, there's a lot of if the whiskey isn't good, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So for the whiskey as a product itself, organic is probably very interesting for some people. I'm pretty sure. I hope so, but that's not why we do it. We basically just want to make a good whiskey. For us, it has some more complex meanings because we are a farm, we're a malthouse and a distillery. So basically what we do here is that, you know, all our fields, there are no pesticides going to the fields. There are no artificial fertilizers going to the fields. Our cows are outside at least half of the year, which is the minimum requirement. And it's even more. As long as there's feed to find on the fields, they're out there. And it's about the animals. It's about the land, the soil. When we grow the grains, we can't grow barley in the field every year. It's actually only once every 5 years that it would be suitable for a field, because two of those 5 years we need to have like clover grass in the fields to, you know, restore the nutrition in the soil, nitrogen, and also to reduce like the pressure from wheat. So it's a whole concept. It's like a holistic concept of growing the grains for the whiskey. It also makes sense that we have the cows here on the side, because obviously if you can only grow barley once every 5 years, maybe only grow like food, maybe 3 in 5 years, then there's feed the other 2 years. So I think we have this kind of a vision. We're not there yet, but if we could make like a dairy production based on the grass, the clover grass that needs to be in the crop rotation, based on like the leftover products from the whiskey production from the malt house, you get a lot of high protein, spires from the malting. You get a lot of draft from the whiskey, you know, from the brewing process that goes directly in the feed to the cows. So if we could get this thing going here where we have this, everything, you know, is tied together in a circle, but we don't have to use our land to grow feed except from the parts that we need to do to get to have an organic balance and everything. If we then it would really make sense for us. And I think it would make sense for, I don't know, if you really like are very idealistic, it just makes more sense than growing a lot of grain to put it in a cow to get a beef in the other side. So this would make it would give us whiskey and beef and milk and everything else in a balance where you don't need to put any pesticides, you know, or anything in the soil that we don't want there. So for us, this makes sense. It's not necessarily for the product or that we, you know, say that it's going to change the quality of the product dramatically. But for us, it changes the quality in the sense that, you know, the whole system behind the whiskey gives, you know, makes so much more sense for us and it feels more right for us and feels like the only right way to do it. So I think that's what organic means to us and what we try to live by. But basically, if we don't make a good whiskey, it doesn't matter. Like, why would organic matter if it's not very good? So it's the quality isn't necessarily about organic, but it's a different kind of quality to the product. It's not necessarily the flavor or the taste. It's much deeper than that, if you can say it that way. That was a long speech about organic, but it's what we feel and live by.
No, it's important to understand it.
No, but.
And that's what everything we do here is 100% organic. So this, all the malts coming out from here is organic, and all the whiskey and all the milk and all the meat and everything else. So that's a choice of production style, so to speak.
Now let's hear the judges.
Yeah. What do you think of Oliver? Yeah. What do you think about your whiskey?
Yeah, I tasted it a day after I get the box. So it's not new for me. Yeah, it's very nice. I said I love it, and I'm very happy to be part of this cask. I love the warming coming from. You said it's spiciness, oakiness, the PX notes. I think it's, for me, it's not so fruity. As some other PX casks, but it's very sweet and nice, and I find these. I had the chance to taste every year your sample of the cask you sent me, and the development over the years with the first season cask, and then the older cask after about two years was very impressive, and this is the final. Of these in a bottle or in a glass. So it's very, very nice. I have to say, my judgment is a little bit emotional because of it's because of you have a nice holidays with your family and it's a nice time. My wife finds in a small magazine that you are there in Tü, and said to me, hey, book that here, you can book the tasting, go for it, and then it all started. So it's more for me, it's a little bit more than only whiskey in a glass. So that is what I want to
say.
So I'm not I'm a little bit what is the word for it, I'm a bit emotional about it.
Yeah.
A little bit biased.
Yeah,
I guess. Biased, maybe. So that's the real judge, Tim.
Tim, you have to do the real judge.
yeah, okay. No, I also love it. It's I was looking up the German word for Pflaum, the English word for German Pflaumenmousse. It's plum jam. It's like it has a spiciness, it has spice, then sweet plums. What I am getting. Also, there are no off notes concerning the cask, concerning the distillate. It's, there's nothing you could whine about. It's just tasty. It's full. It's round. Already, how old is it? 3 years, 4 years?
3 years old. Yeah. It's 3 years and 3 months. Yeah. That's, or 4 months. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing what comes out of my glass and what's on my tongue for that age. I didn't taste it when it came out of the first cask, but what I have here is very, very good. And it's just it has this slightly fatty note, but I love that. It's cool. Yeah. Also in the nose, it makes it round, full, accessible.
It's slightly more broken up on this one because you have those tannins there. So I feel that, you know, when you have the fattiness from the other whiskies you tasted, when you get those, you know, slight bit of tannin, it actually breaks up some of that fattiness a bit. So it feels a bit less like that, but it's still there. It's in the flavors, in the nose. It rounds everything, but it sticks in a different way. Like it, because you have those, you know, the balance with the oakiness. And that's what, you know, like Andreas said, that's the thing that we really like about this cask, because mostly what we do is bottle, you know, old sherry casks that we don't have a lot of seasoned casks lying around. So we don't get that much oakiness in the sherry. So this is a quite unique cask. This one, and there's a sister cask for this. There were like two PX casks from this generation of shared cask, and they're not too far. You know, they're quite alike. So there's like these two, but that's basically it. There's nothing in our warehouse like this, and that's you know, that makes it very unique for us as well, because this is an experience for us tasting something that we we wouldn't normally aim to make, you know, exactly this cask, because we wouldn't normally work with these season casks. And it brings something different. And what we like about making these shared cask programs is that often actually it's we present something that we know, so we have an idea that this is going to work well in the number of years that we say it's going to take. So that's like the first very important thing. But then afterwards, it's also trying to just, you know, do something slightly different. Because it's also, a good place to make small experiments, just doing something slightly different than we normally do. So the casks, these casks are some of the most unique ones that we had lying around. And I don't think we have anything like this that we could bottle in the next, at all. So this is quite unique in that sense. So I like it for that. And I like the balance for this. And these casks actually, you know, it's something we discussed that, you know, the balance that we achieved in this cask, it could actually change our opinion on using season casks more, because it brings something good as well. It brings in complexity if it's dosed in, you know, just the right amount. And I think that actually happened here, that it's quite balanced. So it's something that's for us that makes sense as whiskey makers as well. And I think it's just a very nice whiskey. And like you said, there's no off notes. The distillate here is just pure. It's not heavy. It's not light. It isn't, at all. It's just very round and mild, and has those like malty, grainy, dusty notes there lying behind everything else. Some fattiness from the oils. And then you get the sweetness from the cask and the spiciness and the plum jam. And I think that's just spot on. It's exactly what you smell and what you taste, right? So I think it's a very, very well balanced thing in the end here. So we're very happy about it. So I'm happy you didn't judge it too hard.
No, I love it. Can't say anything else. I'm very impressed. Congratulations also on Oliver for participating in the Casper Owners Program.
Yeah,
I think that it was the only chance to get a bottle of your whiskey, because the day of the tasting, you had no bottle to sell, I think.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So we had this problem for a long time, and even still... now we're bottling like 1,000 or 2,000 bottles at a time. I think when you went here, it was probably maybe 500 or 600 bottles for the largest bottling that year, I think, if it was even that big. I think it's like that starting up. If people catch interest, then suddenly you didn't make enough. It was just,
yeah.
And you never know, because maybe this year we talked about, we're building a new warehouse. We're making 35,000 liters of whiskey this year. In 2017, it was 4,000 liters. So it's like almost like 10 times as much. Wow. But who knows? Like in 5 years, we might be like, why didn't we make more whiskey? Like what were we thinking? We need more whiskey now. So, but maybe not. So you just never know. It takes so long time. You know, developing the whiskey that it's very hard to plan.
Mm-hmm. But if you want in Germany, you can find Tü whiskey online in a store.
Yeah.
So we have one at the moment, one reseller in Germany. So audience,
we have a big handful in Germany, a big handful.
Okay.
Yeah. On our website, actually.
Yes. In my online research, I found one. And
okay.
But for our audience, if you Google Tü whiskey in Germany, you will find some bottlings, and you can buy one.
Yeah, so, you can. And I think you would probably be able to find, you wouldn't be able to find that in Denmark, actually, but maybe you could even find back to like the number 10, like the 10th single malt might still be available. Yeah. But you know, older than that, you couldn't find that now. And in Denmark, I think it's only like the last one or two that you can even find at a retail. And I think at our website, you can find the retailers and bars that use our whiskey in Germany. And I think also KDB is supposed to get it in the next year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Berlin.
In Berlin, yeah. It's like we started out in Berlin along with a few other brands from Denmark. Not whiskey, all of them, gins and rum and other stuff. And we're just slowly working out from that. And it's not a large scale operation. It's just trying to, you know, connect with some good retailers and bars around and see where that takes us. So right now that's what we're doing. So you can find it. Yeah. And it's not only in Berlin. Yeah. There's also other places in Germany, in Munich and, in Hannover. And, yeah. So you can find it some places. It'll be more probably slowly a new retail there and, you know, around. But yeah, you could see it on our website. We have a list and a map of the places where you can look for it.
Nice.
Or at least ask for it. And they you know, if it's there, they can get it. Yeah.
Perfect. Tim, do you want to say something else?
I wanted to interrupt you. No.
Yes. We have to say thank you. It was very nice, almost 2 hours of it's talking fine. About your whiskey. Very interesting. It reminds me of my holiday. So I'm back in the Tue National Park and in your distillery and your warehouse. And so thank you for that. Thank you for this. Details about your processes, about how you're making whiskey, about your philosophy of making whiskey, about your farming and all the stuff around. Very interesting. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thanks also from my side for being here in our little podcast. Thanks for making such great spirit. I'm very excited for the next things to come. What also manifested with me is that, Olli and I have to travel to Denmark in the next couple of years. Hopefully it will be possible, at some point again. By the way, I was in Denmark this year, but, on the other coast, I was on the eastern coast of Denmark. So not near to, but,
You're welcome. Nice. Always welcome.
Yeah.
Andreas Jakob, thank you so much.
Welcome. No, I hope it's for us. It's do a good podcast out of this if possible, and we just enjoy talking to you and getting some some feedback and impressions from around. It's always when we're in the small bubble at the west coast of Denmark, you can always turn blind into what you're actually doing if you're not trying to get some perspective out there. So we always use any conversation anyone from abroad to get some feedback on that as well. So thanks for that. Yeah.
No, thank you. Also again, always great to see, that there are people outside of Scotland making great whiskey. So keep it up, please.
Yeah. Yeah, keep it up.
We're stuck with this, so we can't stop now.
Okay, guys. Have a nice evening.
Thanks for the talk.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.